Folks, welcome to the March 9th Aries Working Group call. This is a Hyperledger call, and so the Antitrust Policy Notice and the Hyperledger Code of Conduct are in effect. We are glad you're here. Is there anyone that would like to introduce themselves? All right, we are glad you're here. Announcements. The Cardia Interopathon is going. Cardia is based on a foundation of Aries stuff and is pursuing medical related credentials as an open project under the Linux Public Health project. They are doing an Interopathon. If you scroll down at the URL here, there's a sign up for that. One of the most notable things being tested is the switch from connection invitations to out-of-band invitations as part of the community coordinated update that's going on. So if you have code that does that and you'd like to test that, that's a really good time. Anything else, Mike?
No, that's probably good.
Okay. So Mike's heavily involved there and has done a bunch of good work around that. So there's also, I believe, machine readable governance is also a minimized form of that is also under test. Mike, is that true?
Yeah, we're testing one of the smaller or more rudimentary parts of that to kind of get people used to the idea and some of the simpler parts before we move on to more complicated things with it later.
And is that trusted issuers? Is that...
Yeah, we're looking at trusted parties. So trusted issuers, trusted verifiers.
Awesome. Cool. Awesome to see that work in practice. So if you're interested, please go sign up. You can also go and observe, although we love people to show up with stuff that they want to test. That's super helpful. The DIDCOM users group is today on Discord. I don't have a link handy, but I will find one. This is an unsync meeting, meaning you can arrive at any point that you want to today and participate in the meeting. It happens in the Discord channel asynchronously. And so that's today. I'll go ahead and update this after the meeting with a link you can get there if you're not already there. Tomorrow is the identity implementers call. This is being revived after a short stint, and that's going on. Here is a link to the agenda. I've been asked to talk about something I wanted to talk about, and so I'm going to talk about trusted control channels for the internet. Spoiler alert: it uses DIDCOM as a concept, so really useful. Regis has a link to the Discord channel for the unsync meeting in progress. Thank you for that. And then, of course, I'm still ringing the bell about the Discord move. If you have not followed the Discord move for all the Hyperledger channels away from Rocket Chat, you will have found that you can't say anything in the new stuff or in the old format that's been moved to read-only. So please go join here. Any questions or announcements that I should have but have missed? Awesome. Are there any projects with a release status or a work update that they would like to share?
I can give a short update on Aries Framework JavaScript. We're currently working on I also just updated the description, but we're currently working on a 0.2.0 release, which should cover issue credential v2, present proof v2, out of band did exchange. So basically the AIP2 protocols, for now only with indie credentials, and we already started working on JSON-LD credential support with CKP and non-CKP signatures, which will probably come in a 0.2.0 release.
Very cool. Thank you, Timo. Any other updates?
Less of an update, rather of a question regarding the Asker wallet implementation. Is this also part of this meeting, or is this another working group?
It is sort of within the larger umbrella of Aries, but isn't usually discussed in detail. Are there questions or things that you'd like to pursue there?
Well, I was just wondering the status of it and the maturity. Looking at India as a case, it seems to me that it's more or less deprecated, as well as more like experimental. Now, seeing the efforts in Asker shows already a significant improvement in performance. Still, I'm wondering how mature it is and how much more or less how welcome is support on that part and how it could be structured and governed.
So Stephen isn't here. So I will, Stephen Curran, he's attempting to have a vacation. I will offer that. That project is the main developer on Askar is Andrew Whitehead with the BC Gov team. I do know that the Askar wallet sits underneath Akapai at this point with the current releases. And there have been some great measured speed improvements and some other things that have been involved there. I do know that the supporter involvement is totally welcome. Reaching out to Andrew directly is probably the fastest way to make that happen. And I know that he'd be grateful.
Maybe I can say a few things because they recently discussed it at the working group call. Is that it is currently a wallet that you can choose and they want to move to it for basically the 1.0 release for Akapai. Speed is improved greatly, but it's sometimes if you, with load testing, it will give errors in like, it's not always completely stable yet. And so that's what they're working on right now. But I think it's getting more stable and stable. And we're also intending to start using it for Airstream with JavaScript soon. So I think it is completely feature ready, but probably needs some like heavy load testing by people that start working with it.
Thank you, Timo, for correcting my assertions. So it's an option for Akapai at this point, and they're looking towards making it the default.
Cool.
Yes. All right. Any other updates? Okay. There are two things that I had identified for discussion today. The first one that I want to talk about is issue credential 2.1, multiple issuance. This is work that Stephen Curran has done that I think we can put a close on at this point, and I have some commentary about that. And then I would like to revisit the topic I brought up last time about backup and restore with some different ideas and some feedback that I received, to see if there's any sort of other things. And I'm also curious what anyone who's already doing backup is already doing in the intent that the goal is to sort of standardize, not necessarily invent something new. So. That's kind of what I had on the agenda. Are there anything that we should add or adjust or change before we get going today?
I have a few issues that have been open for a while and haven't seen any comments yet. So if there's time left, if we could discuss them, I can add them to the bottom of the agenda.
Yes, I think we probably will, and I'm grateful for that.
Thanks.
For the record, this is always open. If you'd like to discuss something, or present on anything, then that's a welcome addition to the group here. So please do. I try to go and find topics that are relevant in the community, but I people smarter than me, it's really useful. So very cool. Okay. So this is PR 692. With a relatively small update that has a significant impact to RFC 453, which is issue credential V2. This introduces a 2.1 release that adds support for issuing multiple credentials in a flow. And I'll give some background here. We have a similar addition to present proof, which allows you to present more than one proof as part of a workflow. This is incredibly useful when you need to answer a question, but the answer to the question isn't one credential, but perhaps a set of credentials, and often with the same schema. So, for example, let's say you had received a credential for the university classes you've completed, not just one for everything, but a credential per class. And if someone wants to receive proof of the university classes that you've taken, then you would need to present more than one credential at a time. And so with some minor adjustments to the protocol, there's a workflow which allows for the multiple presentation of that. This is the correlating change for actually issuing credentials of the same type that there are multiples of. And the advantage here is one of user experience. It doesn't actually mechanically change much about how the credentials are actually issued, but provides a shortcut from a UX perspective for the user to consider or approve or accept all of these credentials in a batch. And so there was a handful of questions or objections to this approach that I believe we have addressed. By we, I mean Stephen has addressed after discussion. And so I wanted to highlight those real quick and then look for feedback that we've got. So the changes to the file are relatively minimal. There's a discussion here that has recently been updated by Stephen that describes the 2.1 feature. And one of the things that he has added here is that this is a dot release, so a 2.1 instead of a 3. And with that, there's the process, you know, if one party speaks 2.1 and the other only speaks 2.0, then the party speaking 2.1 needs to back off and only use the 2.0 features of this. And so that's described, and there's a couple notes later on about that. But this basically describes the use case that makes that actually occur. So I'm going to expand here. Let me see. So it updates the name and version, of course. Here is the state transitions that are affected for this. There's some clarity here about how that actually works. Getting to the meat of the proposal here. The idea is that when you're offering a credential, you can signal that the number of credentials that are actually available as part of this process. So the multiple available attribute is a new attribute on offer credential. And there's a description of it here. It defaults to one if absent, indicating that this is the only credential. So if it's missing, then the current flow is the exact flow that you would engage in, meaning you're being offered a single credential and you can receive that. If it's more, then there's extra behavior that can be engaged in. There is a note here that indicates that an issuer that supports the 2.1 version of the protocol should not indicate that they're available by doing that. And so there's also an issue credential with a more available flag that didn't get highlighted yet. And here it is. So here's the more available as account. That's interesting because this says true. So there's an inconsistency in here that we've got to resolve. Dang it. Okay. So this is the optional field that describes this. And it describes how it ought to be used. If it's a positive integer, the issue will move to the offer sent state while it waits on a request credential from the holder. That's not a request credential either. There's another thing that I think we need to change. The idea here is that you can loop within the protocol, and I wonder if the diagram itself has actually been changed. I think I have to go to this. I don't think this diagram has actually been updated as part of this process. The idea though is that you can jump after you issue a credential, is that the holder can jump immediately back to the point of receiving another credential again. So the usefulness of this is that the user can accept this all at once without having to handle it differently. And I apologize, I don't have a, I'm stumbling slightly as I present this. The major objections to this were, one, how to handle fallback or how to handle a client that doesn't support multiple issuance. And there's a variety of reasons why even in the future you might not want to do this. But the common case would be that the user, when they're being offered a credential, they can understand that they're being offered a set of credentials. Like, hey, I'm proposing that I issue you, you know, say 7 credentials of the same type. And then the user can accept those. And then the protocol can engage in such a way that all, you know, 7 of those credentials or however many are being offered are received as part of the same user authorization. And that helps because, you know, they don't have to hit accept 7 times or even more, depending on the type of credential being offered. And then all of those can arrive in set. One of the objections that Daniel Hardman raised was that the likelihood of having an error is even higher if you're offering the user a set of credentials. This is mostly mitigated by the fact that the schema for all of the credentials is the same. These are not independent schema types that are being offered, but only credentials of the same type that are being offered, but just simply different values. And that's declared further up in one of the changes at the top, where it describes the basics of 2.1. And so with that understanding that it's all of the same type and that there's better discussion of how you back off of this if a 2.1 capable issuer is talking to a 2.0 capable holder, you know, what the proper flow is there. The nice part is that when you back off, you end up with just what we have now, which is, individual invocations of the protocol that would then likely prompt the user individually for each of those cases. So the credential issuance can still happen and all of the same mechanisms are in play, but it just lacks the UX improvement of sort of asking the user to consider or realize that there's that many credentials in a bunch or in a collection. So that's how this goes. There's a couple of comments that I'm actually going to make to this to solve inconsistencies. One of them is the true versus the number thing that I just found while talking here, but also other consistencies, but they're not substantive in the fact that they're changing what's going on. Does anyone have any comments or thoughts about this? But the goal is that if we are past that point where the thoughts are there, that we can move along and avoid delaying this any further.
I have one question on. I haven't read the RFC thoroughly, so it's probably in there. But if there is a parameter that says more available. And you say it can be used like this flow to accept multiple credentials at once. Will you need to send all credential offers first? Because before accepting, you probably want to see the contents of the previews of the credentials, or how would that work with this flow?
So I'm pretending to be Steven with marginal success here. He knows that detail. And I forget exactly where it drops back in. And I believe that, the multiple of available there. Let me go back until I have it highlighted. So multiple available with a count, that there are this many of the indicated type that are available for issuance. One of the things that I want to highlight here is that the danger of receiving a credential that isn't what you expect is substantially lower, of course, than presenting a credential that you don't necessarily expect. So that's not a particular danger that we have here. For example, if you get issued extra credentials, then you can, of course, just remove them on your side. So it's a little bit less of a danger there. So available.
Sam, if I understand correctly, it's more or less a way to offer so that you can, from a UI user experience point of view, represent several credential offers in one screen that you can then accept. You have one accept button instead of several ones for individual verified credentials.
It is, but to the point, you can't actually display the proposed attribute values for more than but the first credential. So you would see the first credential and say, by the way, I've got seven more like this, but not actually see those values.
Yeah, and it would, I think it would be more useful in that case, because we have one thing where we issue multiple credentials. We now just do it by issuing, like, sending multiple offers at the same time. And like UX wise, that isn't the best thing. But like, if you could just share a common parent thread ID or something, I think, between the ones, and then you could automatically detect they're all related, and you should, for example, UX wise, show them together. But you would need to have all the values to be able to accept them. And if you do it like serially, like first accepting the first, and then you start offering the second credential and requesting it, like it feels just like doing the protocol over and over again.
Well, from a user's perspective, it does, right? The goal is not to make the protocol not happen over and over again, because there's useful things there, but rather to not make the user suffer through that process, right? Hitting the accept button like 10 times in a row would be really tedious. So the goal there is to provide the user a better way to accept those. So what this talks about is that there's the issuer moves to the offer sent, meaning it's acting on the same offer that it had before. And when the holder receives this with a positive integer, they move to the offer received state. So they're acting on the same offer, but the credential they would actually be receiving is in fact different than the offer itself. The schema, to be clear, would be the same, but the values would be different as provided.
But wouldn't that would actually degrade the functionality of the initial protocol, because beforehand he had to review multiple credentials, statements about claims about himself or herself. And now he's only checking the first one and the schema, so the metadata, but it's not verifying or approving the statement, the claims about himself or herself. So it's not comparable. It's not complete same thing, putting everything into one request or offer, right? So it's a bit.
So you are correct, but I think that there's an implication here that is worth addressing. The process of offering your credential there. Let me go find the diagram here. The process of offering the credential is one that's cryptographically necessary, so that when the user actually accepts the credential offer, that they can send the credential request. And the reason why that's useful is that for non-creds, you need to provide a commitment to a blinded link secret in order for the issuance to bind to that. So the credential request here is what actually goes across with the cryptographic information and back. We have sort of decided in the community that it's also necessary for the data to actually be correct there. And I want to offer that the damage incurred by receiving an incorrect credential is incredibly minor for two reasons. One, an issuer issuing something about me is only in effect if I actually present that credential to somebody else, right? So let's say someone claims that I graduated with a 3.0 out of college when I in fact graduated with a 4.0. Just because they issued that credential doesn't mean that anyone else can see that data unless I choose to disclose it. So I can, there's not really a danger in receiving an incorrect credential. It's an inconvenience, but there's not really a danger as part of that process. Second, all I have to do is delete said credential And because of the way this works, there's no proof that the issuer can really lean on that says that I hold a credential of the particular attribute any more than exists before they issue the credential at all. So while technically it doesn't offer each credential for review prior to receipt, I'm not sure that that actually carries danger. Now, I could be totally wrong on that, right? Does someone have a use case where there are dangerous implications of skipping the preview step for a received credential?
Well, it's more from my remarks are more, and I'm completely against it. I'm just trying to understand. So I'm just from it feels from a pattern. To make it to simply restrict that it's now possible to review the other offers as well, just the first one, and there might be seven additional ones, doesn't feel right that you're just reviewing the first one. Now you're arguing it doesn't matter even if he's accepting the first one, if he's even reviewing the first one, because it's only needed to provide a blind link secret so that a proof of the link secret so that the credential can be bound to it. So it kind of questions the whole process in general, rather than motivating to run this extension. But again, I'm not fully against it. I'm not too much involved in it anyway. So just
top of mind. I think I agree here, because it's quite a big change to the protocols, like implementation wise, and you lose a lot of like context, because you can only send one offer message which contains a credential preview. So if issue seven credentials, you can only have preview for the first credential. And it also seems to me quite in the attachment format specific, because I don't know how this would work when using it with JSON-LD credentials, for example, because the request message contains the attributes there. So I wouldn't know the attributes to put in the request I sent to the issuer when using JSON-LD credentials. So it makes it only applicable to indie type credentials.
Why didn't you simply just say put all the input message off and offer and just replicate it multiple times and send that over, so that way it will receive this once. You can then, on the user's point of view, can simply represent it as once. You can eliminate all the additional information if you don't want to share it, but from a protocol point of view, you can still send it.
So the answer there, Richard, is, I believe, and again, I'm channeling Stephen here, is that they were looking for a simple way to do this, not the creation of a whole new protocol. And so the approach that he took was to try to find the minimal additions he could to allow this to happen instead of you know, trying to sort of invent a flow which would perhaps be a more full feature complete way of doing this, but then, you know, require substantial changes to the flow of the protocol.
No, I wasn't suggesting a change of the flow. For instance, so we did something similar on the verification side, where we wanted to ask for multiple proof requests, multiple proof presentations. So we were aware that we can put everything into one proof request, but then either you can present one valid presentation for the whole proof request or you can't, right? So what we said, if we have several credentials where you can either one of them present the proof presentation or all of them, we put them together in a batch, so to say, and sent them all over. And then we managed it on the holder side to say, okay, which one do I want to answer, and then return it as a presentation. Similarly, you could do it here as well, like have a meter level on the top where you put in the batched credential offers, send them over, and then the holder, the wallet, can then decide how to present that to the user, and then have a batch potentially as well returned to to the issuer. As long as it's not an intention to reduce payload on the traffic, reduce traffic on the network, you can have achieved the same user experience without, you know, adapting the protocol too much.
Are you proposing that multiple attachments are attached to the offer credential message as the change, or the creation of a meta protocol that would be executed prior to this one to then optimize its way through this protocol?
So I'm simply proposing that you could send multiples, that you can make one message, and then you put in what you would do today, put one credential offer and put multiple credential offers into it and order it, like the first one, the second one, the third one, the first, fourth one. And it would be still independent one, but it would be wrapped into one message.
So the only way to do that is either to create a totally separate meta protocol that then would drop into this protocol upon acceptance, or including multiple offers as individual attachments. Is that the attachment method is what you're proposing?
Oh, the other one.
So the creation of a brand new meta protocol that would execute prior to this one.
So not as a protocol, but rather as a wrapper. I'm not proposing. I'm just asking if this would be a possibility.
Well, anything's a possibility.
I think this was already proposed as part of this pull request, but in the end was decided not to take on because it adds a lot more complexity to the flow.
So I think that the objection here, I think I've got captured here. I wanted to, Timo, understand from you a little bit about how this would affect JSONLD credentials differently. You mentioned, for example, that in the attributes are actually provided in the request, which means that there isn't a way to offer a set of different credentials.
I think for indie credentials, there's a preview when you offer a credential, you have a preview where you can add the attribute, but the indie attachment doesn't actually contain the attributes that you're going to issue until you're actually sending the credential over. For JSONLD credentials, you basically, as an issuer, offer a credential, which is the JSON object with attributes. And then I send that same object back like, hey, I'm requesting these attributes. So if you send an offer the first time and then you reuse that for each of the requests, then you basically request the same credential 7 times, for example. So then we would need to add custom wording in how you should leave out the attributes in the request, and you only see them once they get issued. But that adds, like, changes how the protocol and the attachment format works.
Okay, I think I've captured that here. That's a really good point about this approach. Okay, do you think I've captured that here sufficiently to?
Yeah, and otherwise I can add a comment to the pull request explaining it in more detail.
Excellent. Okay, I appreciate the discussion here. This is one that's been kind of hanging for a while, and so I keep trying to bring it up and we're unearthing important issues that relate to this. So I appreciate the feedback, which is good. Any further commentary on this? Okay, so I want to talk quickly about backup and restore strategies. It doesn't have to be very long, but I am curious if folks have feedback on this specific approach. So as a quick summary last time, I discussed the idea of allowing for some standard schema to exist. And this is a bit of a meta format, you know, that I'm describing here, but also allow for applications specific data dumps to be part of a backup. And what that means is that if you're using libindy or something or other specific application data, you'd be able to include that in the backup file. And this would allow when the backup is being restored to the same application or an application that understands these other things, it could actually restore from there and possibly get more detail back than was in the standard schema. So there's some pros and cons to this. The good part here is that it's really easy to get started, and applications don't have to sacrifice the sort of the innovations that they've made in the process of doing a backup and restore. And I'll give you an example of what one of those innovations might be. If the standard format contains contact information for the, you know, the other connections that you actually have, there may be some extra things that your application does. For example, it may allow you to tag things in a way not yet supported by the standard format, or maybe you automatically calculate a most recently used list so that you can put the most common contacts at the top of some list. And you would be able to, of course, export the contact information in a standard format, but then it would be nice to be able to retain some of that stuff if it's restored to the same application. This isn't stuff that's critical for operation, but is nice to have when, you know, if someone's doing a restore. And that's the concept that I offered up last time. Credit goes to Kim Ebert here. He argued the point in a separate call. He reached out to me about the idea that that rather than having a totally separate way to export that application specific data, that you would instead allow for standard schemas to be augmented with custom fields. For example, here would be a standard field, and then you could simply stick a custom field for, you know, directly within there, and that would make that happen. The reason he liked that idea and it was because if we come up with a decent way of doing custom fields, it means that other people can just adopt those custom fields without there having to be sort of a larger effort to standardize that format. Rang true to me to the point, I'm not sure what the answer is here, but I wanted to bring that up and record it as an option because I definitely think that provides a more organic way to get to that level of standardization. The other realization that I had when considering this is that the pathway to standardization, well, a couple things. First, I don't believe we're even remotely done innovating on agents. We've just begun, which means that the types of data that we might need to back up are likely to change substantially over time. And so this isn't the type of problem where we can just figure it out and then it's just done and we don't have to worry about it anymore. And so having a backup format that is flexible for future progress is going to be pretty critical to the success of an effort. And because of that, trying to figure out the basic ways to make it flexible is hard at the moment because there's different sort of options and different ways to make that happen. Part of what I had already had in my mind was the idea of sort of a standard backup format, which acts as a backup container that can contain various types of information. And the idea here is that it would be this backup container would be designed in a way that should not be frequently updated or would not need to be in order to handle lots of the innovation that we have. And that would allow for us to continue to use sort of the same basic structure, even though the internals would change as innovation occurred. So the idea here was that creating this would allow for streaming compression and encryption. And that way you can use it on relatively low memory devices without having to have the whole thing in memory at the same time. It also abstracts the internal details from the user experience of like having a backup file. And would allow for other things that relied upon this sort of meta backup restore container to work, including some of the storage in the backup and restore protocols that I talk about here in a second. And so that would allow us to have really useful things we can create now, but innovate within as we move forward. Richard, your hand went up and then went down. Do you have anything you want to say?
Yeah, we just wanted to add to the general backup and restore topic that there might be, so there is a similar effort in device binding from Paul Bastian, from you might have heard of. So the issue is that some credential, as there might be more sensible, must not be copied, so they need to be protected, hence should be somewhat as well be protected from being completely backed up. So we in Germany had some examples where we wanted to reflect some, or we wanted to reflect some credentials according to the EIDAS regulation that need to be copy protected. So backup and restore will also be part of that. So just wanted to put it in without suggesting any improvement or what, just to have that you have it on your plate, that is probably need to be somewhat consolidated.
That is in my head, but is a little bit orthogonal to the process of actually backing up all the stuff that can be backed up. So I am aware of that concept, and I'll go ahead and add it in a note to my notes here so it doesn't fall off. But yes, yeah. I'm totally aware of the idea that some credentials ought not to be backed up. There's some deeper discussion there about is there a way to enable restore to a device that still has the key in the hardware security module, or should it just never be backed up in the first place? But that's sort of a peripheral conversation to the underlying stuff that I'm hoping to sort of make some progress on. Real quick, the last of my concepts here is that there's two types of sort of backup and restore sort of location things that I think would be useful. One is an obvious one, which is you'd use whatever the backup capabilities are of the device. For example, if you're going to export it to some particular location, which is going to be picked up by a PC or an enterprise server backup, I do know that there are some locations, at least within Android, that if an app places data, that it will be backup and synchronized across other devices. And so that could be a mechanism of taking this sort of meta backup container and then backing it up to secure or redundant storage or, you know, other sorts of things that are useful. And so this is a pretty simple approach. I also like the idea here that there could be backup providers that offer this basically as a service, so that you can configure it and then your agent will periodically back up to that to that service, and it happens in a bit of a more automated way. One of the interesting challenges here is how do you identify yourself to such a service to receive a restore? And these are simply ideas in that you are provided code or a sequence that you can later provide to identify yourself. You would print and store that safely, or it doesn't have to be printed, but it does need to be stored safely so that you're likely to be able to get it back. And that mechanism necessarily needs to be different than a sort of the normal wallet related identification that we do, because it involves the actual restore of said wallet. So using anything that happens to be in the thing that you're backing up ends up being a problem. I like this idea. Of course, a wallet vendor could offer an integrated backup if they desired, but it would also allow the backup vendor to be different than the wallet vendor. And there's some really cool sort of market effects of making that actually happen. The other question that I don't have in my notes here that relates is that how does this affect a scenario where you might have multiple agents and each of them has a different wallet, and maybe they're all the same, or maybe there's actually some differences between them intentionally. And that's another interesting discussion about how you would handle this. But the first goal here is to simply handle the sort of the common denominator case, which is I have an agent on my phone and I'd like to back up that agent so that if I drop it in the ocean, I could restore it to another one and continue to retain the same information that I had previously. Any thoughts on this issue?
I think it's great, and I would like to start working on this. Have this integrated in more of the mobile wallets, because currently I think it's not really great how the exporting and importing and portability of mobile wallets works.
That's also a concern of mine, which is why I'm attempting to go down this route.
And the backup process would include the link secret, correct? Yeah.
So it's intended that the backup process would include everything that it can. So in the case where you have a link secret that is in an HSM, that would not be able to be contained there. Similarly, any keys that were contained in an HSM. And there's a related topic to this, which is for things that cannot be created in the backup, how do you facilitate the rotation of those to something else? For example, if I have a key that's in the HSM of my phone, what can I back up, or what can I contain, or what can I prearrange so that when I restore it to a new phone, I can then create a key there and then affect the rotation to that new key for all of its purposes. So that's a good topic, but sort of needs this backup and restore topic to have some progress before we can really have a solid conversation about it. So the scope of this backup and restore is that it would contain everything that it's capable of containing, obviously excluding anything in an HSM.
I'm thinking currently a little bit from a mobile wallet point of view, where one of the advantages is having it closer to the wallet is that you don't have a centralized point where you attack it. Now, coming probably with a vendor who offers you to back up, it's again reducing kind of a central point to get credentials. So this might be something to think about, because right, the backup must be equally protected like the credential on a mobile device itself.
Of course. So I only lightly highlighted it here, or rather up here. But the idea was that this would be encrypted prior to being stored anywhere else, either on disk or something else. Ideally, with a key that is, of course, you have a way to get, whether it, you know, be a passphrase or some other thing, or something that you print that could be scanned later or something. But yes, absolutely, the security is every bit as important there, so that someone isn't able to capture your backup and then assume your wallet. That's sort of a necessary problem here, right? The alternative is to not back stuff up, which is a terrible plan, given our propensity for destroying our mobile phones. And so, but your point is absolutely correct.
Have you thought about code sequence? I mean, could also be, it's like generating a private public key pair, and then using something like mnemonics, I never can pronounce the word, but where you have like with your crypto wallets, you have like 20 words which you can recover your private key basically, and therefore authenticate yourself against a restore process service to actually get
clear. Yes. Data. So I didn't include this here, but the idea of identifying yourself to a service to be able to even retrieve a store is useful there. One of the thoughts that I had is that the code or sequence could actually be your own private key, but it wouldn't unlock the whole wallet, of course, for them, but it would unlock something that would allow them to prove who you are in a way that matches. Anyway, the idea here is, yes, the same mechanism could be used for the actual encryption here. Now, studies have shown that humans are not particularly great at this. They won't actually provide the level of protection that they ought to, but I'm unaware of anything that's better as far as allowing for a hack-proof way of doing this. One of the things that is also an interesting discussion is that, can you shard or otherwise split your backup into pieces such that the compromise of any single provider cannot produce your wallet, but they would all have to be compromised in order to make that happen? A related topic is, could those backup providers in fact just be your social contacts? Could you pick five people that you know and give them each a fifth of your backup, and then go through that process for social backup and recovery? That's also really good, but I think that we need to, again, make some progress in the simple case before we approach some of those more advanced ones.
Well, Like you mean like issuing a backup credential or something?
Well,
that you can request as a proof presentation to recover or something.
Presumably, if you have social contacts, you have other ways of authenticating the fact that you are who you say you are. Like it's your mother and they recognize your voice, right? And so one of the interesting bits about social stuff is that you can spread them to those people, and ideally you have another way to communicate with them that's out of band, if you will. And then when you send a request to them, they're going to be like, I'm going to make sure that I know who this person is before I actually release the chunk or the shard of their backup that I actually have. And then you can make that happen. But the same thing could more or less trivially happen by allowing you to split your backup into multiple pieces and using multiple backup vendors. And that would reduce the attack surface such that each shard would by itself be useless and you'd have to have them all in order to make it work. And that's relatively trivial to implement, and I think could be part of an initial backup protocol for a backup service, meaning I'm not required to give them the whole backup. I can just give them a piece of it. And that way I may decide to use several backup services so that I can do the sharding in that way. We are out of time. Timo, I totally apologize for not getting to your issues. Are they more urgent than next week, or should we bring them up next week as the first topic in our meeting?
No, next week is fine. No problem.
I will make that happen. If you do have comments about backup or other things, the link is in the agenda and you can go ahead and add notes directly in here, either using there's a commenting feature that you can use inside of HackMD to add comments. And that would be awesome. I'll go ahead and try and continue my work here and report back the progress that I make. But I appreciate everyone coming. Thank you for being here. And I hope your week is a wonderful one. And we will hit Timo's issues next week. Thanks, folks.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.